Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini in the Instax Mini 7 and the Instax Mini 25, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Photo Publicist, providing worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development for the photographer, turning photographers into celebrities. You can find out more information over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the highest quality work known to mankind anywhere on this planet. Unbelievable developing, scanning, and of course, output on high quality Fuji Crystal Archive. Unbelievable cool stuff these guys are up to. And remember, you don't have a photograph unless you have a print in your hand, and you need to print your pictures. This is important. You need to supply proofs to your customers and even print your own work, because it's not about looking at it on a monitor. It's about holding a print in your hand. Definitely check these guys out at Richard Photo Lab, of course, at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5. DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.dr5.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com for the camera strap that will not slip off your shoulder, guaranteed bar none, the coolest strap around. Our friends at Iger Studios for the finest quality drum scans known to mankind, igerstudios.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be joined with Bob Shanebrook. Bob's got a brand new book out, Making Kodak Film, the Illustrated Story of the State-of-the-Art Photographic Film Manufacturing. Bob graduated from the Rochester Institute of Technology and worked at Eastman Kodak Company for over 35 years before retiring in 2003. At Kodak, he worked as a commercial photographer, a researcher, product development engineer, film manufacturing manager, and for over 20 years, he was the worldwide product line manager for Kodak Professional Films. He's been involved in every aspect of Kodak's black and white and professional film business. Bob's going to join us today to talk about his new book. We're going to talk about film, his years at Kodak, and a lot of great stuff that he's been up to. Bob, how you doing today?
Good. Thank you for putting me on your program. I appreciate letting people know what I'm up to.
No, we're honored, and I really appreciate you joining us today on Inside Analog Photo to have you talk about yourself and this brand new book, Making Kodak Film. That is very cool. Quite intriguing.
Well, thank you.
So, Bob, let's talk about yourself. Yeah, I know you went to RIT, and you worked at Kodak for many decades.
Yeah, I graduated from RIT in 1969. I graduated a little early, so I actually started working for Kodak in March of 69, and have been involved somehow in the photographic business all the time I had worked at Kodak. Actually, I started working there summers as a commercial photographer while I was going to school, and then I started working full-time in March of 69.
Now, you went to RIT for just general photography or something special?
I took photography with a lot of emphasis on photographic science in the School of Photography. My professors were Dr. Zakia and Dr. Todd, Dr. Shoemaker, and Les Strobel. Anyone who went to RIT knows those guys, and they probably are well aware of the books that they have written through the years that are pretty much the basis of practical photography from a scientific point of view.
Do you find that RIT or any institute is still teaching traditional photographic science?
Not as much as was done in the past. In fact, a friend of mine is getting his doctorate in remote sensing from RIT. And the expression I use, he doesn't know one side of film from the other. He's strictly a CCD photoreceptor guy. He knows a great deal about imaging, but film, from his point of view, is not something he needs to know about. He knows lots about sensors and optics, but very little about solar halide technology.
What's your thoughts on Kodak inventing the digital sensor and digital imaging and how they sort of cut their own feet off?
Well, you and I hadn't talked about this. I have a very different view of that. I worked in KAD Research Lab from mid-1969. I started in March, and right after the moon landing, I switched to a research lab. And the guy in the lab right down the hall from me was named Steve Sasson. Steve's the holder of the patent for the first digital camera. At the time, I was working on liquid crystal and photoconductor imaging. Steve and I talked a lot about what he was trying to do. I switched jobs in January of 74, and his patent, I think, was filed in 75. So I was working on non-silver halide technology. I was working on liquid crystals and photoconductors, and Steve started working on CCDs. What we were doing is trying to figure out what other technologies were out there, and I guess that's what you do in research labs. Steve did a very good job of taking technology that didn't really exist. He had some components, and he put them together. Interesting, in that box where he got the CCD, somebody from Intel wrote, "Good luck." They mailed him the CCD, and Steve put it together. It took him about a year, I think, to put it together with the various components that he purchased, everything off the shelf, and built this blue box, which was the first digital camera, and he logged it using a oil well logger. And he could make a picture. In fact, I gave him the target that he used for the first photograph. It's a picture of a boy with a dog. That was a test target I used called Boy and Dog. But as far as Kodak cutting off their feet, they did exploration and lots of different things, not with the thought of how we're going to crush this technology, but rather what's coming down the chain. Certainly, the Kodak industrial engine was built around making silver halide films, and there's lots of stories about that. And Steve's work was done, patented, and basically hidden away in a closet, not intentionally, but Steve went on and did other things and wasn't for quite a while until the technology matured enough to become a commercial venture. Interestingly, in his report, he predicted when he thought that the technology would mature enough to be commercially viable, and I think he missed by something like 6 months. And I think he said 15 years he thought it would take for the technology, but I can't be held to that. And I think I have his report here somewhere. Steve made a prediction of how long it would be, and he almost hit a bullseye on it. It just takes a long time for the technology to mature. So did they cut their legs off? Well, I don't think Kodak tried to control the world. Remember, they were buying the CCD from Intel, and Intel ended up going other places with providing devices for people that eventually became good enough to be used in cameras. Did it hurt Kodak? Oh, yeah. The silver halide technology business is certainly nothing compared to what it was 10 years ago, but technology comes and goes. It's certainly one of the most rapid transitions, I think, in history from a technology point of view, but that's kind of what happened, and there's not a whole lot Kodak could do about it. They've done things in the digital world, but if you're making lots of film and nobody buys it, doesn't matter how good the film is, if another technology surpasses the technology that you've invested literally billions of dollars into.
So really, Kodak can't take the blame for the decline in film because of their invention or their patent from their employee creating digital sensor, digital imagery, because like you said, this would have happened no matter what.
There's a lot of smart people in the world. Steve happens to be one of them. There's no reason that General Electric couldn't have gone to Intel, given them, I don't remember how much he told me he paid for the sensor, not a whole lot of money, a few thousand. The rest of the components that Steve bought were off the shelf. He used a tape logger that's used in oil wells because he wanted something that was robust and didn't have to worry about it working well. The lens he used, he went down to the manufacturing line at Elm Grove and borrowed a zoom lens off the production line, and everything else is off the shelf. So Steve or a number of people could have done that in their basement. Steve just happened to be the first and have the ingenuity to put all the bits and pieces together to make it work. So if Steve hadn't done it, perhaps someone else would have. They might not have done it as quickly or as well as Steve did. Interesting, Steve bought a copy of my book. I'll also point that out. He bought one of the first copies.
Really?
Yeah, he understands film. He knows about film. He learned a great deal in building his digital camera. He used the resources of the company to learn more about photography. So when he built the camera, he did the tone reproduction things he needed, etc., so that he was able to be successful in building the blue box that he built.
When you were still at Kodak, your last position, you were worldwide product line manager for film.
Yes.
How did that interact with the digital people? Because when you were still at Kodak, Kodak was manufacturing and really heavy in digital imaging and their own cameras and so forth and so on. Did you find one side would fight the other? How could you do a marketing program with you pushing professional film and being the product manager and have another division at Kodak making their own digital cameras? It must have been difficult.
Well, they were in another division. And I know most of those people. In fact, the guy who ran the professional camera business, we occasionally shared a secretary, and his office was on the other side of the conference room from mine. So I'd come over and poke at him, and he'd come over and poke at me. If he did something that really looked good, he'd make these big prints and come and show them to me. And I'd show him what we could do with portrait film. And a lot of those people came up through the photography world and were Nikon F shooters with Kodachrome and Ektachrome film. So they know photography well. We were talking to the same customers, but we never really got into serious arguments, if you will, about that's my customer, not yours. That didn't matter. It was important for us to be successful for film, and it was important for them to be successful for digital cameras. So that wasn't an issue in the professional side, and we typically, at trade shows, talk to customers about film and then march them over to see the digital things because the customers were interested in both. So it didn't become a competitive, I'm going to do this and you can't do that sort of thing. We kind of did it together. There is a question about would it have been wise for Kodak to spin off the whole digital technology. In retrospect, I think it probably would have, but that would have made us more competitive with each other rather than trying to help each other. But it would also have had the advantage of kind of giving them their own space, and maybe things would have come out differently, I don't know. But I'm not sure that it worked the best for Kodak for us all to be in one company doing the same thing. We didn't hurt each other, certainly, but if they had had their own space, they might have had a different view of how they did things, but that's something that we'll never know. Typically, companies do spin off technologies, and that may be a wise thing to do.
Let's talk about the space program.
Oh, I was incredibly lucky. I graduated from college in March. I didn't actually graduate then. Graduation was a few months later, but I stopped going to school, so I started working for Kodak sooner than I had planned. I think they were a little bit trying to figure out what to do with me. But there was a program that NASA initiated. There was a space available in the lunar lander for an instrument. I don't remember what was eliminated, but a guy from Cornell, I think, came up with the idea, a geologist. They decided that they wanted to have a camera that the astronauts could carry that would photograph a very small area of the surface so that the geologists could see the surface of the moon in addition to carrying rocks back. So they wanted to photograph, I think the image area was something like maybe 2 or 3 inches square. So Kodak had a contract to build what's called the walking stick camera. The official name was Hollow Lunar Surface Close-Up Camera. So Kodak had a contract to build some number of these. And what it was like a cane that on the end of it had a little bigger than a Quaker oatmeal box. And inside that, there was a roll of Ektachrome 64 film and 2 stereo lenses and 2 magazines and an advanced mechanism and electronic flash. Described as an oatmeal box with a stick on it, the astronaut would set down on the lunar surface, and there was a trigger in the handle, like a cane handle. You'd pull the trigger, the flash would go off, and you'd take a stereo pair of photographs of the lunar surface. I think it was carried on all of the lunar landings. That was kind of fun because I had just started working. I worked on the project from March until the landing, which was in late July. Saw the thing in the lunar lander. I also made sure that I touched every camera that was delivered to NASA so that any camera that went to the moon, I made sure that I, in some fashion, touched something that went to the moon. So that was kind of fun, but that program pretty much came to an end as soon as the landing was successful. Kodak provided more cameras, but I didn't need to be involved anymore at that point. So it was fun, something different.
No, that is very cool to be able to be involved in something like that. When you look back at your time at Kodak, what part do you like the best? From being a photographer for them, a researcher, product development engineer, film manufacturing manager, I mean, a lot of stuff.
I liked making black and white prints, color prints. I like printing. My goal was to do printing. I like doing the commercial photography. But the things I'm most proud of is T-Max films and portrait films. When T-Max started, Kodak hadn't done much in black and white in many years. And my boss, Ray DeMullen, asked me to start a lab to learn more about black and white and see if we could improve the products. So I was pretty much given a blank sheet of paper. And I had been interested in black and white photography and done it since I was a sophomore in high school. we sat down and kind of figured out if we were going to make a new family of films, what would we do? What would the speed be? What kind of technologies were available? And because Kodak hadn't done much in black and white in years other than make miles and miles and miles of plus X and tri X, nobody really paid any attention to us. We were pretty much given a blank check to do what we thought would be a good idea. We didn't get much advice, supervision, or guidance from above. We had a team of really good people, so-called true believers in black and white photography, that put together what we thought could be done from both technology point of view and what people might want. That ended up being T-Max films. So that was really rewarding and kind of fun. And for Portra had a lot of attention, and same with Ektachrome films. Anything we did in Ektachrome films and anything we did with Vericolor 3 got a lot of attention because it was such a successful and important part of the business. But we were able to do some things in the Ektachrome films. I did not do the latest version of Ektachrome. Most of those were developed and managed by Gary Van Scooter and T.J. Mooney. But I did a lot of work with Kodachrome 200 and Ektachrome 64, Ektachrome 100, which is called EPP, and we did a version of EPY, which is a tungsten film. And 64T, I did all those, or managed all those. And then Portra film, we were given the charge to replace Vericolor 3. At the time, when we went out to talk to customers about Vericolor 3, typical response was, you can do anything you want, but don't change Vericolor 3. That created quite a high hurdle. We were able to do some things to build the Portra business and build the Portra product performance, so it wasn't an issue, but it actually took us a couple of attempts before we actually got to where we wanted to be. So Portra, I think, was a pretty good accomplishment. Actually, the most rewarding thing about Portra films was as we went down the line and we had a little Vericolor 3 left, we couldn't give it away. The people said, why would I want Vericolor 3 when Portra is so good? So that was some good news and some bad news. We ended up throwing away Vericolor 3 because no one would buy it, but they liked the new film so much better that it was a success. That product launch went very well, and the product's been very successful for Kodak. And technically, it's a very good film. The film family, actually.
What do you see now with the technology that Kodak has? And we'll go into this in the book because it's really amazing what they can actually do. But nevertheless, on that, do you find that the current offerings that Kodak has, is this the top of the heap? Do you think they've been restricted on what they can do? Or when it comes to silver halide technology, this is as good as it gets?
I actually make a statement in the book that the films that Kodak made in 2009 and 10 are the best films they've ever made. That's my opinion based on the performance and their ability to do what I think customers want. There's a lot of tales about things that could be done with old films and papers, but when you go back and really look at them and look at the data, you're not impressed. The current films, I think, are the best, both from customer performance point of view and from a consistency point of view. The things that can be done today with the modern technology they have in the sense that both the emulsion making and encoding facilities are far better than anything we could do 10, 15, 20, however many years ago you want to state. And as far as the offerings, the product line had to get smaller, but what they did, the things that have been reduced in their product line were reduced because they weren't being purchased. If people were still buying vast quantities of Kodachrome, which happened many years ago, they'd still be making Kodachrome. It's not an issue of they don't want to make it, that the volumes have gotten so small. Volumes have gotten small when I was still there. It does amaze me that they were still able to provide Kodachrome as long as they did, because the volumes were very small compared to anything else. I don't think most companies would have continued Kodachrome. The volumes were so small prior to 2000, we had looked at one that made sense to continue to make it at that point. They were able to keep things tied together long enough to reach this year, but I am a bit surprised that they were able to keep it alive as long as they did. It's a great product, but the world's tastes have changed, and we saw that many years ago. Prior to 2000, the volumes were dropping. I was managing Kodachrome up until, I think, around 2000. I mean, it might have been earlier than that. But we had done a lot of work seeing how we were going to keep that business alive. The volumes were small. If they had only sold as much film as the number of people that said they bought it. I was at a dinner last night with somebody, and he's, oh, yeah, he shot all this Kodachrome. And I said, when's the last time he shot any? He said, 15 years ago. So I think that's not atypical to this business either. I mean, a lot of businesses are like that. People say they use more product, but when you add it all up, sometimes the consumption in people's minds is far greater than it's actually consumed.
Well, that's the deal. If people would buy this product, Kodak would make it, or Fuji would make it, or somebody would make something, right? So we see discontinuance of product, no matter who the company is, because people aren't buying it.
Yeah, there are occasions when things get discontinued for technology reasons, but typically if there was sufficient volume, the companies could afford to invest in the technology and improve it. But when the volumes get really small, it's very difficult when you have a business with huge startup costs, like what you have to do to build a single film to keep it alive. And anything pretty much from a film point of view that Kodak or Fuji or Ilford can make that they think people will buy and it makes sense, there's no good reason for them not to make it. So no one's saying, boy, we want to get rid of that. We don't want to make those customers happy anymore. That's not the real world.
There was a big backlash, of course, with Kodachrome, but even with Tri-X 320 in medium format. Is this just because of volume, you think, that they discontinue these products? It's not a technology reason, then.
Certainly, Kodachrome's not a technology reason in the sense that if the business was there, they would make film improvements. Through the years, we had looked at alternatives to Kodachrome 64 to improving the product. And we know that other people had looked at making K14-compatible films, but the other people didn't enter the business because they didn't think there was enough volume there to make it worth their while. So the same thing is true here. Tri-X 320, that's a good film. I used that film. That's what Ansel Adams used when he was tired of dragging around view cameras. He switched to Hasselblad with the Tri-X 320. But he particularly liked the toe and the shoulder shape. He processed it in HC-110 and just gave him these too grainy pictures, in my thought. But when I used HC-110, pictures were too grainy. When he used it, it worked great. Can't figure that out. But from a volume point of view, I know the volume of Tri-X 320 went down, and that's what forced them to get out of the business. There was certainly no technology reason. In fact, one of the last things I did at work, around the end of 2002, we moved a number of films from an old coating room into Building 38, which is the newest high-tech coating room. We made that transition and we made it public, and Tri-X 320 was one of the films we moved into what we call Building 38, which is the new coating facility that was built in 1990 and upgraded a number of times since then. But that's the main coating facility for the company. The company only has two coating facilities now for film. They're both in Rochester. One is the 14 room, which is a sensitizing room, and then this down the street is Building 38. And they make all the films for both the motion picture and the still photography business. Film's not coated anywhere else in the world that I'm aware of at this point.
What's your thoughts on Transparency Chrome E6 product? Why is it still alive at all?
I'm rather amazed that the product line is still so broad. They got rid of a few, but the main films are still available. Well, there's a couple of things that happened. One thing that kept that alive is the foresight of some people at Kodak. They looked at the business and said, looks to us like digital photography is going to come on. Our current manufacturing facility is built to make large runs, and they did some things to give them the ability to make somewhat smaller runs. And as a result of that, they're able to make some of these Ektachrome films that if they had been using the same sort of philosophy that was used in the 80s, I don't think they'd be able to make them anymore. Simply because in those times, the volumes were huge, and they were making lots and lots of product. And once you get the machine making film, it's a good idea to keep it running, and you're making large batches. But I think they've done some things that they can make somewhat smaller batches, though I'm sure it's difficult and more expensive than it had been. The unit manufacturing cost for a single roll has probably not gone down because the volumes have gotten smaller. The unit manufacturing costs may have gone up. If you make less of something, you expect it to cost you a little more. But some of the projects that people have done in both film manufacturing and supported by the research people have allowed them to keep these smaller volumes alive. I'm kind of surprised. I thought they would have been forced to discontinue more films than they have.
It's really amazing that they still have the product, and with the introduction of Ektar 100, that seems to be a replacement for Chrome. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, Ektar 100 is an excellent film. It's a revitalizing of an old name from the Ektar 25 film, which had magnificent performance, but had some other difficulties. I think it was a difficult film to make. Ektar 100 uses a more modern technology, and if you look at their press releases, they talk a bit about how that was done. And the same people that did Ektar 100 are largely many of the people that were involved in the portrait films. And they gave the research and development guys something to do, and it was build the best color negative film that you can. And I think they did. The performance of that film is far superior to anything that existed prior. So it's a very good film, and I think people are using it. I doubt if the volumes are the same as we would have expected from even Ektar 25, because fewer people are shooting film, but the new Ektar film is a wonderful film. And substantiates my point that the films they're making today are the best films they've ever made.
Why do you think people are still shooting film?
Well, it does things other things can't do. One thing is people are using it. It's very predictable. The thing that's a little understated or underrealized, I think, is that particularly amateurs or consumers are going along shooting all these images and storing them on a magnetic medium of some kind, thinking it's going to last forever. Those materials don't last 100 years. I can show you family photographs that are 100 years old and they look very good. Whether the media will be able to produce your images in 100 years you can look at, or whether you'll have enough proper equipment to look at the old images, remains to be seen. Too many people, I don't think, are printing their pictures. I print my family pictures on color silver halide paper. I use Kodak galleries most of the time. And I know from the data that I've seen generated on color paper by Joe LaBarca and by the Image Permanence Center at RIT, those prints are going to last a couple hundred years, far longer than I need. But if I take all my pictures and I store them on a CD, DVD, or just leave them on a compact flash card, I don't think I'm going to be able to look at those pictures in 10, 15, 20, 25 years and have them usable. So people who think they're going to keep all their pictures on some sort of medium other than silver halide photographic paper are probably going to be surprised. Inkjet papers are good and certainly a step in the right direction. I don't think they have the image stability of current generation of silver halide papers or chromogenic silver halide papers. But without printing your images, I think people are taking a risk that they're not aware of. Film works good.
Yeah, well, people don't print. That's the big problem. They shoot digital and they think it's free because they've already paid for their gear. And yep, they end up with hard drives full of stuff and then things crash or the old computer gets tossed out at the garage sale and pretty soon you're SOL. You don't have anything.
Exactly. There are still a lot of people shooting film and the conversations on APUG show that. I do a little test. I go into the local grocery store. I rub my hand over the top of the film box by the checkout. Typically, I get a little bit of dust off. This is not good.
No.
And typically, the film's been hanging there a while. So from that, you can get an estimate on how much the consumers are shooting. Obviously, a lot of professionals are switching, but I think that there's also an awful lot of people that are still shooting 120 color neg for weddings and other things. Some have switched to digital, but from a professional photographer point of view, it's sure nice to have a 120 negative and then send that to your lab, like Miller's in Kansas, and they scan the negatives on various scanners and give you very high-quality silver halide proofs or whatever you want. And it's fast. All you have to do is ship it off to them in FedEx. They put the files out pretty quickly.
What we found is that's the only really growing segment of a professional market is wedding and portrait, because the people that are in the business now have been getting into it. A lot of them have only shot digital, and then they discover film and find out that it looks better, it's organic, whatever they like about it. And there's a growth pattern in wedding and portrait of, you're cool now if you shoot film.
Well, and the digital picture quality is fine, but there is a difference that you get from a film captured image and then looking at those prints. You get a very nice gradation of tones. Color reproduction is typically pleasing. You don't get the garish colors. You don't get the artificial sharpening that has a tendency to get included in a lot of digital pictures where you get some ringing around fine detail. It's really irritating. For my daughter's wedding, which was 5 years ago, I had two photographers. They both shot some film and they both shot some digital because I wanted to have that coverage and I wanted to also have the ability to have the quality of film images. So you have a little of each. I'm glad to hear that the wedding photography attention is being given and there's some growth from the film side.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we get some complaints on our program here that, well, you guys feature too many wedding photographers. But these are the people that are shooting and consuming volumes of film that we chat with. Like you said, a lot of the guys and girls in APUG, there's a very vibrant community when it comes to film.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not really eating the volume. They're like you said, oh, well, I shoot a ton of Kodachrome. Well, yeah. So it's an interesting market segment that's growing, actually, and consuming these products.
Yeah, I think a lot of the commercial guys, just due to the demands of both from a timing point of view and what's needed to produce input into the printing industry, In the old days, the thing you do, you'd shoot a chrome and you'd make a dupe and you send a dupe off to be reproduced for an ad. And today, demand is, I need a digital file and I need it now. So I don't think you have the time available for most of the commercial things to wait for film to be processed. You're waiting for film to be duped. In the case of wedding photography, the timing isn't quite as demanding, but the demand for the quality product is still there. Nobody wants wedding photographs that aren't quite as good as the photographer can normally do. That doesn't mean you can't do it with digital, but I think it may be a bit more reliable for the photographer to shoot film.
Especially look at the stuff that you developed. Look at the Portra line. And even with the current offerings of what they have in Portra, that you have such a latitude with shooting color and egg and the way things are scanned now and how everything is in this hybrid digital workflow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, digital is too sterile. It just doesn't look right. It looks antiseptic.
There's a timing issue from demands on the photographer point of view. A lot of digital photographers spend the time shooting, then they spend an awful lot of time editing. The old joke for photographers was that you make your money behind the camera, not standing in the darkroom. So that's what led to the growth of the color labs. And now, instead of working in the darkroom, I think there's a lot of digital photographers that are spending their time sitting behind a computer screen with a trackball, editing pictures and doing other things. When if you shoot film and scan and go, it doesn't seem to be quite as much labor required on the part of the photographer. It depends a bit upon the individual photographer's workflow. But I know that some spend a lot of time editing their digital pictures because they capture so much. And in the traditional proofing way, you just have a bunch of proofs and you show them to the client and they pick what they want. But photographers ended up spending time sitting behind a computer screen. So it's a matter of the individual photographer's workflow.
Plus, too, you have this whole generation of kids that have grown up completely digital. They've not known anything analog at all, okay? And
yeah,
there's these companies that are doing great marketing with these cheap, funky plastic cameras, Holgas, and all this other stuff. And
yeah,
the younger people are finding out that they can get this cool, funky little plastic camera and stick film in it, this amazing thing they've just discovered. And they
yeah,
can do cool stuff. And I think there's another rise in consumer level spending on analog product in that category as well.
Well, whoever thought that the Holga and the Diana and the single-use camera would be a significant portion of the silver halide business? I know the largest consumption of film from a still camera point of view is film that goes into single-use cameras. That's quite a turnaround. I personally kind of always looked at them as a joke, but it turns out that that concept is very viable and people continue to buy them. They can make the cameras for relatively inexpensive price. The performance is quite good on a 4x6 print, and it kind of keeps people in the film business. The Holga and Diana is a whole other thing. Opens the door to people that would make this great discovery. They can buy a little relatively inexpensive camera and do some neat things.
You can, and it's interesting. I had a gentleman on the program a few weeks ago that does these fine art landscape panoramic shots of the Old West out in Nevada. He uses a 1990s era vintage Kodak Funsaver 35 panoramic camera that he reloads in a bag out in the middle of nowhere and tapes it up.
Okay.
And that's his camera, and his stuff's unbelievable. And he's selling stuff
yeah,
that's in galleries. People are eating this stuff alive.
It's not always about the technology. It's about what the photographer can produce. I mean, a really skilled photographer, he doesn't have to have a 16x20 Deerdorf. He can kind of go out with a Diana and do the same thing, or in this case, a single-use panorama camera with probably a 20-cent lens on it. Those cameras, I think, only sold for $12, so how much money can you spend on the lens?
Right. The only problem I have with the disposable cameras and reusing them is some of the disposable ones, the 35mm film cartridge, had a
yes,
sawtooth gear in the center spool.
Exactly.
And you couldn't reuse the camera. Some of the later ones now, you can just stick a regular 35mm roll in it.
Yeah, they did that to avoid two things. One, overuse of the camera. And secondly, people getting the old cameras, putting another roll of film in and reusing them when the cameras end up getting overused. You don't know how many cycles it's gone through. So they went to that sawtooth shaft instead of the conventional shaft.
Right.
To keep people from doing that. But I'm sure somebody's worked out a way to make a little cap to put in there to fill it in. People are ingenious, and we always had to be careful about counterfeit film. You can print a carton pretty inexpensively. I'm not aware of any significant counterfeiting that went on that didn't get shut down quickly, because those things happen.
Yeah.
There was counterfeiting with no film in the magazines.
Wow.
So if you buy film for a low price, you kind of wonder if there's any product in it. Typically, it got shut down within days of when they first went to market, but occasionally we would encounter that.
Bob, what's your thoughts on the motion picture film, The Vision 3, the newest, coolest motion picture film that's made to be scanned? It's low contrast, the curve is very linear, and it seems to be that you can shoot in the dark, you can't kill the highlights. It looks to be that it has even more latitude than the current Portra line or even Ektar. Do you think Kodak could do or should do a digital film, a film that's made to be scanned? It's not done to be optically correct so you can optically print it.
That approach had been talked about for a number of years, and I pursued that for a while myself. For the motion picture business to do that, it makes sense because the users are pretty sophisticated. They're trying to tie into a rather complex imaging chain, and they have pretty good control of things. We looked at it from a still photography point of view. We could never come up with a strong enough driving force. At least the timing of this was probably 10 years ago. Yeah, that's probably pretty accurate, 10 years ago. We played with it. I know some folks in the Kodak Research Lab actually made some films and things were done. We were never able to come up with enough of a benefit to make it worthwhile. They, in fact, apparently have now been able to do some things in the motion picture side to make that a worthwhile activity. Whether they will ever do that on the still side, I don't know. That's not something that anybody would talk to me about at this point. I just don't know if they're going to consider that or not. But we did look at it and didn't think we would be able to do it successfully in the context of around 2000. It might have been a little before. It might have been 98. We were just looking at Portra and what we're going to do next after Portra. But I understand the Vision 3 films are very good, and Kodak's done well with it, and the people that did the work in the research lab, I think, have gotten a lot of recognition as a result of that.
Really, this stuff's amazing. I mean, but like you said, the normal person doesn't have the facilities to strip the rim jet off before it's developed. And, of course, using ECN2 uses a different developer than C41, so...
Yeah, it's something they can do in the cine world. Whether they would choose to do it in the still world, I don't know. I would be doubtful because the motion picture labs can deal with a lot of differences, and it may be more difficult for the still labs to deal with that. They may have to do some other things in order to accomplish it. The goal in a typical C41 lab is have everything go through the workflow pretty much the same. They don't like segregating films in the typical C41 lab. And that's one of the advantages of Portra. When we were doing early exploration work on Portra, I went out and talked to a lot of labs. I asked them what they thought they needed in new films. This kind of happened when I was in Dallas. I was visiting some labs. And they said, whatever you do, don't give us any more films, so we have to have different setups for printing. And they said their biggest problem was that we and Fuji, every time we came out with a new film, whether it was Pro 400 and there was a Pro 400 with a lower contrast, Fuji had a high-speed film, we had a high-speed film, we had Miracolor 3, and every film that came through the lab required a separate printing setup. So a little light bulb went on talking to these guys, and we ended up having Portra films so they would all print on a single channel. And the labs were just delighted. That really helped the quality of the work they put out. They had a lot less waste. They had a lot fewer mistakes. It led in a large part to the labs encouraging photographers to switch to Portra, as opposed to the photographers just doing it on their own and dragging labs along with them. The point is, there's a lot of factors that get involved, and putting another whole different workflow may be too difficult from the still point of view at this point.
What's your thoughts on current offerings from other vendors about what's available these days as a C41 color neg film or even black and white?
Black and white, there's a lot of offerings in the black and white side. I know Ilford, I don't know if they've cut back any on their black and white films or not, but they offer a nice range, and I think the work that they've done will keep them in the film business for a while. From a color negative point of view, Fuji cut back a lot on their C41 professional films. And I think that was just volume driven. There's no magic here. If the volume goes down, it's difficult for them or anybody else to maintain full product line. There's only really two players on the color negative world. On the chrome side, as I recall, Fuji dropped a couple of things.
They have a pretty heavy lineup of color positive film.
But so does Kodak.
Yeah, definitely.
So EPR is still there. I think EPP may not be available in quite as many formats. VS is there. Ektachrome 100G has been very successful.
Did you find, with your reign at Kodak, that there was this competition going between Kodak Fuji? they'd come out with something, you'd have to come out with something better. Was there always this little competition sort of fight going on between Carnegie and Chrome?
Absolutely. If you look at time versus product introductions, there's a number of fronts that we would invest in. Let's see, this year, what should we do this time? Should we put our money into a tungsten film, or should we put our money into a high saturation film, or should we put our money into a 100 speed film? And if you make a little plot of time versus product introductions, you see that both companies are very active, and it's kind of like a you throw a left and they throw a right, and you throw a left, maybe you throw two lefts. You only have so much money to work with, and you got to decide how you're going to invest it. And you can't work on every film at once. You're better off picking what your product introduction plans are going to be, and you invest in this film, and you invest in it for a couple of years, and then you go to another place and invest in something else for a couple of years.
Because of the lower growth of film and how things are somewhat flat or still decline, you find there's still a competition going back and forth between the two? Or have people sort of mellowed out now, and it's like, well, let's just try to stay alive?
I don't know about the marketplace, because my vision of the marketplace isn't any different than yours. My suspicion from both companies' point of view, I think they're both looking at what they can do and making improvements accordingly. But they have less resources that they can spend on everything from advertising to promotion to sponsoring photographer events for marketing, and less money that they can spend in the factory making product improvements or productivity improvements.
Do you think that if there wasn't such a large consumption of motion picture stock, that Kodak and or Fuji would be making film at all?
I can't predict what's going to happen from that point of view, but I can say that, and it's pretty obvious from the reports from the companies, that the existence of the motion picture business is certainly critical to the existence of the still business. If the motion picture business were to go away, the size of the amount of still film that would be made or could be made is going to change. I mean, you've got this big factory that's real good at making lots of film, and the motion picture film business consumes a lot of that. If you take that volume out, you still have to keep the lights on and keep the floor mopped and be able to make the material. It's going to be real hard as the motion picture side goes down drastically for it to be a problem. If you look at Kodak financial reports, they're saying that in the future they're going to depend on other sources of income other than the film business. It doesn't mean it'll disappear, but I don't think anyone's going to forecast that the volume is going to increase at any time. So will it be around in some short number of years? Probably. Will it be around in large number of years? I can't come up with a number, but I think it's going to be difficult in 50 years for Kodak or Fuji to be making film. It may become difficult for them in 20 years. Forecasting, that's something I'd be particularly good at.
I guess if we knew, we could just go buy some lotto tickets with the right number on it. So,
yeah.
Bob, tell me about an 18%er.
Oh, 18%er. An 18% gray card is sort of a standard tool. I think it was conceived by a guy named Ralph Evans, who was a photographic technology guy at Kodak and has written a number of books on color theory. The view was that if you take the world and integrate it, you come up with 18%. The other joke is the sky in Rochester is always 18% gray because it's overcast. But this is a sort of a photographer's, I don't want to call it a fraternity because it wasn't even close to being that well organized. A fellow named Bill Semenko, who was a photographer for the Port Authority of New York and ended up being the regional manager for Kodak, started this little group for 18%ers, and you'd be invited to join it if you made a significant contribution to the photographic world. And Bill would give you this little 18% pin that said, I'm an 18%er. And there was a secret handshake and a secret recognition code, which I certainly can't disclose, in which if you thought someone might be an 18%er, you would ask him a question and they had to respond in a proper way. But it was something that Bill had put together that wasn't Kodak sponsored in any fashion. Actually, I think Bill bought the 18% pins with his own money, and he'd give them out to photographers in New York and other places. And it didn't matter if you were a Kodak customer or a Fuji customer or an Agfa customer or an Ilford customer or if you worked for one of those companies. If Bill thought you should be in his club, he'd invite you, and had a lot of interesting people in it, and people wear these little pins around. It's since gone the way of other things, but it was an interesting thing that Bill had done.
No, I always thought it was quite cool. Let's talk about the book. You have this book out that is extremely revealing about Kodak technologies. I mean, I've been through tours of Building 38. The stuff's pretty militaristic, guarded secret, and you come out with this book that just blows it all open.
Well, it was done with Kodak approval and blessing, though. It was clearly my idea and not something Kodak would have come up with on their own, I don't think, at any level. But about the time I was retiring, I had been doing some work at the George Eastman House. George Eastman House had a program called the Advanced Residency Program, which was for photo conservators so they could go back to wherever they came from after studying in Rochester for 2 years and be more knowledgeable about how to conserve photographs. Their knowledge in the darkroom and handling prints and all those sorts of things were very good. Eastman House and RIT had done a very good job of amassing a faculty and putting together a program that really made these people very good at recognizing types of photographs and storing them in a proper fashion, and in some cases, increasing their longevity. But as far as their knowledge of how film was made, they just had no idea. I mean, I tried to explain this to people, and they kind of got the idea, but I wasn't able to show photographs of things because no one has ever allowed to photograph in Kodak Park, which is a bit ironic. So I arranged to take them on tours, and that helped, but I could only handle 10 people at a time or something like that. And Kodak wasn't particularly interested in having a lot of people tromping through their factory. They don't do that very frequently. Well, security problems, but equally, in fact, almost more so, from a cleanliness point of view, you don't want a lot of people going into where you're making film, because it's tough to keep it clean. So I thought about, hey, wouldn't it be good if we could document this? And all this work's been done by Kodak people for over 100 years, and nothing has been documented. We lived by the slogan, you press the button and we do the rest. But no one was ever told what the rest entailed, particularly in making film. So when I retired, or when I was preparing to, I went to a person who was running the film business at that time, Mary Jane Hellyer, who has since retired, and said, I wanted to document. The business is not going to grow. In fact, we'll probably decline in some time. Why don't I document this so that all the good work that has been done is somehow made available to people in the future? They see more than the photographs in the little yellow box of film. At some point in the future, people can be made aware of all the good work that was done. She agreed with that, gave me permission to photograph anywhere I wanted in Kodak Park, talk to anyone I wanted, and put together a document. We did not say when I would publish this, and I was prepared to just put it in a locked box, but I wanted to record it. So I went on my merry way photographing, gathering. I had known all the places. I had been in all the places I photographed. I spent 40 days photographing in Kodak Park, and more days than that talking to people and gathering data. And far more days than that putting the book together. But I've gone and photographed and put together drawings. I have 130-some photographs in the book and 25 drawings that show the flow of materials through the process. Everything from dropping silver ingots into nitric acid to film coating, acetate coating, finishing, all the steps that go into making film. When I got close to the end, I reached the point that they said, yeah, I can go ahead and publish the book. They reviewed it. It was in review at Kodak for like 8 months. In excess of 30 people read it to make sure that it was correct from a technical point of view. I knew most of the things, but I really was lucky, and I was given the technical expert in each manufacturing area was assigned to help me. So I was able to make sure everything is technically correct. Make sure all the diagrams are correct, make sure I'm reporting the important information in how the film was actually made. So as a result of that, I was able to put together a book that some people call it a technical book. I don't. There's no chemical formulas. There's no mathematical formulas. But it explains in photographs and captions and diagrams how film is made. I think it's easily understandable by somebody that didn't work in the factory their whole life but has some knowledge of photography. It pretty much explains how things are done and how the whole photographic manufacturing operation kind of comes together.
If you have a chance to go into Building 38, and of course, people will see this when they buy your book and look at this information, but it's so complex, it's so over the top. It's like there's a bunch of alchemists there turning lead ingots into gold. And I can see releasing this information on Kodak's standpoint, it's like, okay, well, if you're stupid enough to build a factory like this, go for it.
Yeah, it's not a cookbook by any means. There's no formulas in there that tell you how to precipitate silver halide in your basement so that you can make hand coatings, but it goes through the operation and shows what's done and what kind of control you need to do it on a mass scale. I don't think people are going to be entering the business building new hundreds of millions of dollars coating facilities. I don't think that anybody that's another manufacturer is going to buy this and go through it and say, oh, if we tear down our factory or re-outfit our factory and renovate things to do things in this way, we'll be able to make a better product. That's just not going to happen. So who are the secrets being kept from at this point in time? Is Kodak going out of the film business? No. Motion picture business is still going on. And as far as keeping secrets, who are the secrets being kept from? We're kind of keeping the secrets from each other. There's no commercial value in anything that's in the book that's going to tell somebody how to build a factory better or change their manufacturing schemes. So it's probably the right time to do it. My fear was this, and that is, if I didn't do this, perhaps somebody would do it in the future. But as time goes on, the level of expertise available to make sure that things in the book are accurate might not exist. I have done a luncheon with my friend Jim Patton for retirees that worked in the Kodak Research Laboratory. We get together and share tall tales. And those folks are getting older, and some of the expertise that existed at one time isn't going to exist in the future. So I thought this was the time to capture it. Don't wait and lose the opportunity. There's a whole lot more work than I had anticipated, but it's done now, and the books are available on my website. And I've had amazing response. See, it's only been on the website for maybe 9 days. I've sold books to 18 different countries, and people are coming out of the woodwork to order books. So the response has been good. The typical response is, thank you, and oh, by the way, I want to buy a book. So I was glad that people are interested in the subject.
I think a lot of people are interested, and hopefully we can help push some more book sales here, because I think if you're a photographer, you take for granted this little metal canister or this roll with paper on it, this thing you call film, and you just stick it in your camera and shoot it. And if people really knew what was involved in making this stuff, they would have more respect for it, I think, just to start with.
Yeah, I make a mention in the book that, is it an amazing process? Yes. Is it amazing that it works? Yes, but it works so well. There's so many things. A single roll of film is 200 components. Each of those components has to be quite pure. And if too much of a component is added, and even in a small percentage, it'll probably ruin the roll of film. So you got 200 things, you put all these together, you coat them in layers, the typical thickness of all the layers together is less than a human hair, and you do it all in the dark, you don't let any dirt get on it, you don't let it interact with anything else. It's exposed to light for a fraction of a second, you're expected to perform well for a few years. You expect the image to last without any change for at least several decades. And you buy a roll of film for $5 or 10 or whatever. It's amazing that it works as well as it does. I was always amazed that we would set out to make a coating of something and we say we're going to coat this and we're going to coat so many rolls and we have to have it done by next Thursday. And they're going to cut it up and it needs to be shipped to Japan or to Europe or to wherever. And everything happened, and it happened exactly when. It came out perfect, and people were happy with it. It's really a complex process, but it worked amazingly well. I will mention my website.
No, I want you to talk about the website, and we're going to have links up to this, of course, on our website, and we'll put this up on Facebook and all kinds of stuff. But let's talk about how people can look at the book contents. They can read about you some more. They can order the book. That's the big thing. Where do they send their money?
I have two things. First, I'll talk about the access to the website. The website is makingkodakfilm.com. I'm going to make it a whole lot simpler. So it's www.makingkodakfilm.com. On the website, there's information on the book. There's 5 pages. I list a table of figures so you can see what all 165 figures are. Some are photographs, some are drawings. 60% of the area of the book, by the way, is drawings and photographs. So it's not Mies and James with 200 or 500 pages of text that you can't quite figure everything that's going on. It's mostly diagrams with captions. Captions are about 20,000 words, so there's pretty good explanation of each photograph. And as far as buying books, I have it set up for people can pay on PayPal, and that's particularly useful for non-U.S. customers. But also on the website is my home address, and people can just mail me a check or money order or whatever. By the way, this is a totally independent project from Kodak. And I'm doing it all myself. It's sort of like a retired person's do-it-yourself project. I have it commercially printed, of course, but I've gone through and had a professional editor, but I've done all the photography myself. I did most of the diagrams myself using various software packages and simplified incredibly complex drawings. For instance, the feed path on Building 38 is a fixed set of engineering drawings. It's very difficult to figure out, but I reduced it down to a very simple drawing so it can be understood. The website's a very good way of reaching lots of people. I've had responses from most of the major countries in the world because of both using website and my friends sending emails to lots of people. So it's an interesting project. I could have just, suppose, written it and given it to a publisher, but then you lose control. And this way I'm dealing with a very high-quality printer in town, and I actually been to the printer several times so I can do color corrections on press sheets and stuff. So I'm having a short run, but very high quality. Interesting, they use Kodak plates, which is kind of a nice touch, too. I chose them because they're an excellent printer, not because they use Kodak plates. That was a sort of a serendipitous surprise. It turned out that's what they do. I also looked at short-run electrophotographic things like iGen 4 and Kodak NexPress. They're excellent products. I still think that traditional high-quality offsets are a better way to go. It's expensive, particularly for short runs, but I'm very happy with the quality. I started out doing color and black and white printing. I'm used to making 2cc changes in color balance. I had this thing done with color correction on every image to make sure that the color came out the way I wanted. The high-quality offset is a good way to go. I could have done it on photographic paper, but I think that would be a bit too laborious.
Exactly. Do you think you'll have a second printing? Does it look like that the volumes are going to be enough that this is going to be around a while, or is this going to be, you better order tomorrow your SOL?
Well, I don't want to turn it into a panic. You have to order it today. The world's going to change. But there's a difficult decision you have to make here. The way I'm doing it, I can't do a whole lot shorter run because the costs just get astronomical. But I don't know how to quite reach the decision of whether I want to sign up to write the big check for ordering a large number in the future. So I put it on the website. My intention is to print this once. Because remember, my original goal was to make this information available to three audiences. One, I talk about the photo conservators, like people that go through the Eastman House program. Motion picture folks are part of that, too. So there's a lot of motion picture information in the book. In fact, the people in the factory almost don't know if they're making motion picture film or still film in a broad sense. So a lot of the information that applies to the motion picture world also applies to the still world. So I included things for both of those audiences. The thing where it becomes different particularly is in the finishing operations. In the finishing and packaging and slitting, I photographed in both the motion picture areas and the still picture areas. So those people are important to my audience. I also did it for photographers so they know what they're using and have an appreciation for what they're getting. And I did it also to recognize the work that so many Kodak people have done through the years. So with one printing, I can really hit my goals. I've sold books to a large number of the major museums in the world, which is where I really wanted the information to be available in conservators. Kodak retirees are buying the book. And through this interview and others, I think I'll get attention by some photographers. So whether I'm going to go into another printing becomes doubtful. Perhaps I would do something like have somebody else do it in the future. My wife and I have been addressing envelopes, so I have these stacks of envelopes around that I have to put with books and mail. So to answer your question, maybe I'll do another one, but I'm not sure. I'm not going to promise it. Any of your listeners who have published their own book have learned, and you probably have too, that some of these things sound like a great financial idea. But as you continue to write checks for printing and other things, it becomes more of a labor of love. In fact, a number of people have sent me a thing saying, well, this sure looks like it must have been a labor of love. I did it because I wanted to do it. There's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow because it's small volumes. You just can't do it. I'm not Barnes & Noble.
So since your physical address is on the website, people can send you thank you gifts then.
Gifts are readily accessible.
Right. So besides the buying the book, they can send you other gifts because, I mean, really, like you said, this is a labor of love. And with your commitment to Kodak for so many decades and all the stuff that you did with Kodak and to be able to tell the story is very cool.
Yeah, and I worked with great people. And it's a little bit of giving back, I suppose. But the people I worked with are just amazing. Not just the Scott D. Sabatos, who people know, who's really a great guy. But also the guys in the research lab, they're geniuses, okay, in their own right. And they're an expert in one little family of dyes for their entire career. They know everything about it. But they've worked in this one little thing their whole lives, and they know it. They know this stuff inside and out, and they don't get any recognition. In fact, many cases, they don't even know exactly how their materials are used. All they know is they know this process. They know how to make this dye, and somehow it ends up in Ektachrome 100 VS film. But they don't get concerned with how emulsions are made. They're concerned with synthesizing a specific small portion. So it gives them an opportunity to see how it kind of all fits together.
So, to make sure, it's makingkodakfilm.com. They can go there and learn more about the book. They can order it. And I think people should get after it as soon as they can. Because like you said, it's not going to last forever.
It's not going to last forever, and I'm certainly not making any commitment on a second printing. I think this will probably be a one-shot deal. And sponsor's been good, and my goal is to get the information out. That's all I'm trying to do. It doesn't have to be available new books forever, so it'll probably go out of print fairly quickly. I don't anticipate addressing envelopes a year from now.
I would have thought that Kodak would have bought thousands of copies of this book to have for their salespeople, their internal. I mean, think, if you're an employee, they should hand one of these books to everybody.
Yeah, I don't know that they won't, but they certainly haven't. There's nothing in the book that's offensive to them. They've gone over it thoroughly and said that, gee, this is really great. Thank you for doing it. But they haven't said, gee, I'd like to buy 25 or 50 copies. Maybe they will in the future, but that hasn't happened at this point.
Well, I mean, think of all the people that worked at Kodak that, like you said, one guy that makes a die. One guy makes this, one guy's in charge of this, one woman's in charge of this deal, and they've worked there for decades, and they can't even explain what they do to their family. And they can show them this book and say, this is what I do. Whoa.
Well, I'm getting a lot of interest from retirees at all levels, whether they're somebody that was in the operations actually making stuff all the way to a number of lab heads who were people in the research lab and people who were responsible for manufacturing in Kodak Park. One nice thing is I have had proofs of this for a while, so I've been able to show it to people just in my everyday life. I haven't had press conferences or anything, but I go out to lunch with people and things, and I show it to them, and they say, hey, that's really great. Sign me up, and they tell their friends. So it does meet a need to the people that used to work in the business for being able to show their families what they did. And in fact, many of them are buying multiple copies. We had a few people that say they have bought one for each of the children or their grandchildren to show them what Grandpa actually did. He actually had a real job. He wasn't just a professional golfer.
Yeah. Bob, I really appreciate you joining us today. We look forward to having you back on the program. There's 100 different topics we could chat about, but I think right now people need to get after it, order the book, send you money, and get this piece of incredible information that when people see this, they're going to freak out. This is great stuff.
Good. I'm glad it meets a need. As I sat here late at night working on this, I kept thinking, is anybody really ever going to be interested in this, or should I go to bed? But I stuck it out, and I hope people enjoy it. It documents what I did and what so many other people did for years. And I doubt if it's terribly different than what the other photographic manufacturers do. So it gives you an idea of how it was done in Rochester, but it gives you an idea in general how photographic materials are made.
Yeah, this is great. Bob, I do appreciate it. We look forward to chatting here soon, buddy. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you very much.
Well, there you go. Bob Shanebrook. What a great guy. Tons of information. What a very colorful history at Kodak. And of course, his brand new book, Making Kodak Film. You definitely need to get this. He's only printed a very limited amount. And when they're gone, you're done. You can get one. Anybody that shoots photography on analog material, no matter what brand you use, you should look at this book, Making Kodak Film. And of course, over at makingkodakfilm.com. This is a great resource. Bob's been a great guest. And we look forward to having Bob back on the program soon to talk about all kinds of great analog photography. The Inside Analog Photo Radio Program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film, and of course, fine quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends at Photo Publicist, worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the finest quality lab in the country, richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at DR5.com. Upstrap for the finest quality camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder at Upstrap-Pro.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios at IgerStudios.com. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at APUG.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House over at EastmanHouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.